Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Jeremy Zettelmeyer, the director of Bruegel. There has been quite a bit of bad news lately: the Russian invasion of Ukraine, high energy prices, inflation pressures, accelerating climate change, geopolitical tensions. The objective of this podcast is to take a little bit of a break from these bad news and make sure that we do not overlook and that we properly digest a piece of good news. And that is that for the first time in 8 years, namely since Latvia's accession in 2015, the euro area has a new member, and that member is Croatia, which joined on January 1st, less than a week ago. And with me to discuss this is Boris Vujčić, a distinguished economist, a friend, and the governor of the Croatian National Bank for over 10 years now, who has been shepherding the process on the side of Croatia. Boris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you, Jeremy.
Boris, as economists, we are supposed to show reactions only to unanticipated events. And this event, meaning Croatia's accession, was surely anticipated. Nonetheless, you have been committed to Croatia's euro accession and worked on it for a very long time. So let me ask you, how do you feel about it now that it has happened?
I feel very good, of course. The project being accomplished, the project was long. Basically, the project itself started in 2017, so it took 5 years or so. And of course, it was also important that now that we got into a situation where we are actually doing a currency changeover, everything works smoothly. So we were a bit nervous still a few days ago or years ago to see whether everything will work, IT systems, whether the transition of the data in all banks will work fine, etc. And all worked fine. So everything works from the real-time gross settlement system to the internet banking, mobile banking. People get their euro cash at the ATMs. So I feel good and now relieved also that there will be any hiccups in the process. The transition was smooth.
Excellent. So maybe before we get sort of into geeky economist stuff, let me just ask you to elaborate a little bit on the background of the euro accession process and on your experience with that process. And then maybe we can talk a bit about your expectations for the impact that euro membership will have on Croatia and maybe on your thoughts on the euro, past, present, and future more generally. So to start with the first topic, so as our listeners will know, except for Denmark, which negotiated an opt-out in the 1992 Maastricht Treaty, euro membership is actually a legal obligation for all EU countries, but countries can influence the timing, and also some convergence criteria need to be met before countries can actually join the euro. Maybe can you maybe just elaborate a little bit how the accession process works? Say something about the convergence criteria and about Croatia's experience with that process. So you already said the process in seriousness started in 2017. So what determined this timing? And then perhaps whether the convergence criteria required policy effort that would otherwise not have happened, how you see that convergence process having played out. Was this in some sense a necessary sacrifice to achieve a desired aim, namely to join the euro, or was it actually useful in itself? And, you know, if there are any lessons or policy advice that you would like to share with other EU countries that still have not joined, that have the euro accession process ahead of them, that would be great too.
Sure. Let me start with the euro accession process in general. As you said, all EU countries are actually obliged to adopt the euro, except for Denmark, which has an opt-out clause. But every country actually, in reality, has ways and means to determine the timing which it chooses. And the way to do that is to join the ERM2 or not to join the ERM2, basically. Once you join the ERM tool, then everything is on the automatic pilot. But you
can... so this is the exchange rate for the people who don't know, the exchange rate mechanism too. Mm-hmm.
Right. There's the exchange rate mechanism in which country has to spend 2 years prior to joining the Eurozone and keeping its exchange rate in a narrow band around the euro. So without joining this mechanism, you cannot fulfill nominal convergence criteria. And although in the treaty it says that the only thing that the country has to do to join the Eurozone is to align its body of legislation and then meet nominal convergence criteria through the participation also in the ERM. So four criteria, actually five, because of the exchange rate mechanism participation. In reality, in order to join the exchange rate mechanism, there is a set of other preconditions that the country has to meet. And this means after the change of the architecture in Europe, after the Eurozone debt crisis, that the country certainly cannot be in the excessive deficit procedure, that it cannot be in the excessive macroeconomic imbalances procedure, that it has to fulfill broadly at least specific country recommendations, CSRs, of the European Commission, and also that it has to meet some of the so-called pre-entry conditions, which are agreed together with the European Commission and the ECB. So this is basically real conditions that a country has to meet before joining the exchange rate mechanism. And this is also what Croatia did. Now, how we did it, we joined the European Union relatively late in July of 2013. But that was still a time when the great financial crisis and Eurozone debt crisis consequences were felt. The situation was not ripe at that time to make a move towards the Eurozone, primarily because the public debt to GDP was still growing and Croatia was a part of the then established as a change in the architecture of the Eurozone, as a response to the Eurozone debt crisis, then established excessive deficit procedure and excessive macroeconomic imbalances procedure. So the first thing was after we joined the European Union in 2014-15 to set the economy on the path of exiting the EDP and the excessive macroeconomic imbalances procedure, which after we joined the European Union was actually helped by the fact that we joined the European Union, because joining the European Union was a boost to the growth. And then once the growth starts, it's easier to bring down the public debt to GDP downwards. So from, let's say, 2015, these imbalances started to narrow. In 2016, it was clear that you're going to exit the excessive deficit procedure. And we said, okay, now it's time to start the euro accession process. And we basically launched it in a year when we exited the EDP in 2017 by preparing the euro strategy, which went out for the public discussion for 6 months. And after it was discussed, the government adopted the euro strategy. This was a formal decision that Croatia wants to join the Eurozone. And then we also informed the Commission and the ECB about that. Now, the process then was such that we agreed with the... So we exited the EDP, then we exited the excessive macroeconomic imbalance procedure. We agreed on the 19 measures in 6 areas, which are kind of a small structural reforms, yeah, with the Commission and the ECB that had to be done prior to the entry into the exchange rate mechanism, which means by spring of 2020. And then we embarked on doing these things. And I must say, all these things are reasonable and good. I don't see any of them as being a sacrifice. they're useful in themselves. I wouldn't say these are major structural reforms, but it's a series of good moves that need to be done anyway. For example, just to give you an idea, some of them are reduction of the administrative barriers for the business, reduction, of course, as I said, and this is an important one, of the public debt to GDP, setting in on the downward path. So, for example, we had a public debt to GDP peaking in 2015 at 84.5% of the GDP, which was brought down by 2019, prior to the pandemics, to 71. So 84.5 to 71, which is a nice fiscal adjustment, which is good anyway, and the country should do it regardless, I would say, of entry into the Eurozone. Then, of course, in 2020, it picked up again because of the massive fiscal stimulus. And then it went in 1 year. That tells you a little bit about what the fiscal space means. You spend 4 or 5 years bringing it down from 84.5 to 71, and then in 1 year it goes up back up to 86% during such a crisis. But then from 2020, where it peaked at 86, until the end of this last year, 22, it came down back to 69%. So below 2019 level, according to our estimate. So it's a really rapid fiscal adjustment, and we see it in a few years going down to 60%, which is our target in fiscal adjustment. So these kind of things are good, and then you have other things. For example, there's quite a lot of insistence on the AML, anti-money laundering, and for example, one very good thing, alignment of the corporate management in the state-owned enterprises with the OECD guidelines. Implementation on the OECD guidelines, independence of the supervisory boards, the KPIs for the management. These are all good things that have been implemented in this process of joining the exchange rate mechanism. And then we met all these criteria. However, just at the time when we were about to join the exchange rate mechanism in July 2020, the pandemic broke out. And then now maybe it sounds that it might not have been such a problem, but I assure you, in March 2020, nobody thought about anything anywhere in any European institution but the pandemics. So that kind of endangered the timing of our entry into the Eurozone, but we were insistent, you know, we met everything. The idea was to postpone it to 2024, the whole process. But in the end, we said, look, everything is done. We know it's a pandemic, but let our process proceed as envisaged and planned. And in the end, it happened. In July, we entered into the exchange rate mechanism. And then we met all the nominal convergence criteria. But in fact, nominal convergence criteria were never an issue for Croatia. Because if you look in the past, we were meeting them since 2016. So all four nominal convergence criteria we met from 2016 until 2022. So it was more about this process of getting into the exchange rate mechanism.
So I suppose that with respect to the debt, it was the very fast projected reduction in the debt ratio that then cleared the way, right?
Yes, and I think this is the most valuable side effect of the process of joining the Eurozone. Rapid fiscal adjustment, which not only happened as a rapid fiscal adjustment, but is somehow built in to the fiscal policy, this mechanism that, you know, you have to have the public debt to GDP on a declining path, faster or slower, depending, of course, on the year, depending also on the growth. Obviously, next year you cannot have such a fast because the growth rate will go down, but it will continue from year to year onwards.
So that makes a lot of sense, as do the nominal criteria. So again, for our listeners, maybe that refers to both the level, the volatility of inflation and the volatility of the exchange rate, right? So
right.
keeping that stable.
Right.
But what I did not know, and I find, you know, slightly surprising, is that you had, you said 19 structural measures. So it wasn't just about macro stability, right? It was also about structural reform. And so what possibly is the justification for that? I mean, these are good things. I agree. But how does one link it to, you know, the prospective success of Croatia within the euro?
Well, that is something that some people would object to, and I already heard them objecting to. They said this is not in the treaty.
Mm-hmm.
But we simply accepted that. We did not even challenge that. As these reforms are also, I can tell you, in reality, something that you agree with the Commission and the ECB. It's kind of the ownership is
it's
there.
It's a common. So it's a common,
not,
yeah.
Exactly. It's not something that you're required, but it's something that you agree to do in the discussion with the Commission and the ECB. And in that sense, it's good. And of course, there is also one important thing which I haven't said, which did not exist before for any other country which joined the Eurozone. And this is that you now have to join the banking union.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the reason is that the banking union did not exist before.
Mm.
And now it has become a formal requirement. So we joined the, this is not called banking union, this is called close cooperation with the ECB. So we joined the close cooperation with the ECB, which de facto is basically joining the banking union in the format that it exists now with two pillars without the third pillar in October 2020. So basically, since October 2020, we are already with one leg in the Eurozone banking union, part of the Eurozone, in which other EU countries are mm-hmm. are not.
Got it. So maybe back to the question, is there any advice you want to give, you know, the next country, whoever that country is, Bulgaria maybe, or in the future Poland, from your experience?
Well, Bulgaria, this it's different because Bulgaria has already joined the exchange rate mechanism.
Right.
So Bulgaria now has a very clear a path. It has to meet the nominal convergence criteria, which at the moment is a bit difficult because of the divergence of the inflation rates in the Eurozone. Becomes more challenging now at this level of the, not the level, but the dispersion of the inflation rates and some of these post-entry criteria that they also have to meet. While for the countries which are EU non-ERM, which have not yet expressed the willingness to join the exchange rate mechanism, it's clear now how it works. Now it's up to these countries to decide on the timing when they want to join the exchange rate mechanism. But I can tell you that the empirical evidence that we already have from not from joining the Eurozone, but from being on the path of joining the Eurozone is very favorable. Let's say, take this last crisis, war aggression on Ukraine. And if you look this year, what happened with Croatia's foreign exchange in the foreign exchange market, what happened with the bond yields, what happened with the interest rates on the loans to corporates or the households, they didn't move, barely they moved. Of course, the yields went up, but pretty much in line with the other Eurozone countries. The spread over the Bund widened only slightly. We did not have to intervene in the foreign exchange market. And the interest rates in the commercial credit market, for example, also are at historical lows, basically at the level where they are now in Germany. While in countries like Hungary, Czech Republic, Poland, they experienced, as it usually happens during such crises, a pressure on the foreign exchange market. They had to intervene. They had to increase the interest rates very rapidly. bond yields widened much more than Croatian bond yields, and the transmission to the commercial credit market, mortgage market in those countries was much faster. So you find now, for example, interest rate on the credits to corporates, non-financial corporates, in these countries being somewhere between 8 and 11%, while in Croatia, the average rate is 3.5%. And we didn't intervene in the exchange rate market. Everything was, why? Because the markets were already pricing in that we're getting into the Eurozone. So they were already considering us probably 80% as part of the Eurozone. So there is a huge credibility effect and a risk premium effect that you enjoy from joining the Eurozone. So that's my take on it. And I would say that the main advantages for small open economies like Croatian of joining the Eurozone are felt during the crisis. In good times, everything's good. Everything's fine. Everybody's fine. You don't feel so much advantage of being within the Eurozone or out. Sometimes you might think, it's better to be out. You can do some things which you wouldn't be able to do in the Eurozone. But during the crisis, it's obvious. The same was during the pandemics. Take, for example, spring of 2020. Huge pressure on the foreign exchange market. In 3 weeks, we had to sell 6 billion euros. Shorting, even banks starting to hedge their equity positions. Complete panic in March. The moment we agreed on a swap arrangement with the ECB, and the reason why we could get the swap arrangement was only because we were already on the path of getting into the ERM, foreign exchange market calmed down completely, which opened up the degrees of freedom for us, more of it, to intervene in the government bond market, where there was also a pressure. And that helped a lot. So we already felt the benefits in 2020 of being on the path of joining the Euro. You didn't have that in 2009, when we were completely exposed to the, to the crisis, or during the Eurozone debt crisis to a lesser degree, but when we also felt the widening of the spreads, the risk of mood in the markets, both on the currency side and on the government bond or sovereign bond yield side.
So you have already answered what would have been my next question, namely the pros and cons of Euro membership. The main con being, of course, that you lose a policy instrument, independent monetary policy. The main pro, as you just explained, a stability effect, particularly in shielding you from crises. But maybe just to push you a little bit on that second point, or to explain where this comes from. So two thoughts. It seems that in a sense, what was happening in the last 6 months, the reason why Croatia was not subject to, say, the pressures that Poland or other countries with flexible exchange rates were and outside the horizon of immediate membership were subject to, is in a sense a mechanical effect, which has to do with the fact that when you are expecting to join a currency union, exchange rate volatility is lower, and of course once you are in a currency union, it's zero, right? And so this is a lot like the original motivation actually for the euro, right? Which was a reaction to the instability of the European exchange rate mechanism, the European monetary system of the decade that preceded the euro. So is that the main idea? So, once you are in a currency union, no investor can, speculate against you anymore in a way that they could if you were in a pegged exchange rate system, or even with just in a managed float with this. Or is the effect related to, other benefits that a currency union may bring, having to do perhaps with the deeper pockets of the ECB, so lender of last resort functions of the ECB, or the benefits of banking union? How do you see these effects?
I would say it's interrelated. I wouldn't say banking union has to do much with that. It's a separate thing. It's not that it does, but that would not come into the main framework of thinking about the costs and benefits. I think the important thing is, on one hand, I haven't said nothing about the costs. Let me just say about the cost.
Yes.
Because perceived cost is loss of the sovereign monetary policy.
Right.
That's the main cost of joining the monetary union. But I usually cite Bob Dylan on that. When you got nothing, you got nothing to lose, you know. And small open economy next to the Eurozone, trading 70% with the Eurozone, having 70% of the tourists coming from the Eurozone, having actually already euroized balance sheets of something, cannot run an independent monetary policy because of the impossible trinity. I mean, you cannot then tie your exchange rate to the euro, which in effect, when you look, although many countries say they don't, in the end, if you take, for example, 30 years, they do. Everybody is pretty much aligning themselves with the euro. We have been doing that explicitly. Mm-hmm. And then when we do it explicitly, and we were doing it explicitly because of the high level of the euroization.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have 2 minutes just to explain what does it mean. For example, if you take the debts of all sectors in Croatia, government, corporate, and household, which are in euros or linked to euro, so basically denominated in euro, it was 130% of the GDP worth of debt linked to euro. So that means that the currency depreciation of 10% increases effectively the debt of all sectors by 13% of the GDP. So if that happens, households have less to spend, C goes down, personal consumption. Companies have less to invest, investments go down. Government has less money, so either it has to increase the taxes or has to reduce the government spending. The only thing that benefits is the balance of payment part of the equation, where you get some competitiveness. But you lose much more on the domestic demand, aggregate domestic demand, than you gain on the balance of payment side. So actually, depreciation works pro-recessionary, not expansionary in this situation. So why would you then stay out of the monetary union when there's nothing for you to be gained there? You cannot use your exchange rate policy actively to promote, you know, the growth in your economy, just the other way around. You're only having this huge risk, which is priced into the price of the capital, in the bond yields, in everything. That's about the cost. As for the other part of your question, I mean, you're joining the second most important reserve currency in the world. If you look at the international financial market, basically there are two currencies that matter and all others that are small. Take, for example, reserves, international reserves. 80% of them are either in dollar or euro. Take the issuance of the bonds, denomination. 80% is either euro or dollar. Take international loans, 80% is euro. Everything else, all other currencies together, are remaining 20% with few percentage points. Although, of course, you have other international reserve currencies, but basically you have two major ones and then the rest. And when you join the second largest reserve currency, of course the ECB has much larger degrees of freedom than to run independent monetary policy and has much more firepower than you can have as a small emerging market central bank, you know, issuing basically exotic currency. That's clear. That for me, it's very clear benefit that you get from there.
Right. So just to recap for our listeners, so the main point, I guess, is that this theoretical benefit of monetary independence for a country like Croatia, so a small open economy that's highly integrated with the euro area, is purely theoretical. And the reason is that you actually cannot use your monetary independence because this would involve depreciating the currency. So if you say you expand in a situation where the Croatian economy needs bigger stimulus than the euro area. You would expand monetary policy, but that doesn't really help you for two reasons. One is you don't really want to have a lot of exchange rate volatility because of trade, right? Because you don't want exchange rate volatility to disrupt relative prices between Croatia and the euro. But more importantly, the point that you make, you have many Croatian companies that have debts in euros, and so basically you're bankrupting them if you allow krona to depreciate. Yeah. That is the fundamental problem. And then related to that, I mean, some may think or say that the even the Fed had problems in March of 2020, right? But I guess the difference between the Fed and Croatia in a situation like that is that the Fed could deal with these problems very quickly by supplying dollar liquidity to the markets. And I guess in the case of Croatia, the point you're making is that Croatia did not have the same option to simply, you know, supply local currency liquidity to the markets because the markets needed euro liquidity, right? Hence, you needed the swap line with the ECB, right? And in the future, you're not going to have that problem because that liquidity will be there automatically, essentially. Yeah.
We had a huge international reserves. For example, our international reserves are 40% of the GDP. That's a lot. But in this type of the crisis, when everything happens very quickly in a matter of weeks, sometimes even that looks like, might not be enough. If you get to the point where, for example, banks start to think about hedging their equity, then you need a lot of money. It's, of course, something which I was trying to explain then to the bankers. It's like shooting your own feet because you're going to lose because of that. We had these discussions, and in the end, it didn't happen. But in this type of crisis, when you have something like that, when there's a panic in the market, even the large amount of the reserves like we have, might not be a comfortable level of the international reserves. So it's this shield that the reserve currency like euro gives you is something which is really valuable.
Right. So let's maybe move to the third and last topic of our conversation, which is your thoughts on the past, present, and future, maybe of the euro. So, you know, for all its strengths, the euro area did suffer a terrible debt crisis about 10 years ago. And, you know, the construction of the euro, at least at that time, clearly had something to do with that crisis. So the crisis was to a significant extent caused by domestic policy mistakes, but the presence of a single currency in the way it was set up back then probably did not help. Now, since then, we have had policy changes and institutional reforms. So in your view, do they rule out a similar type of crisis in the future?
Well, I think that we are now in a much better position than we used to be before the Eurozone debt crisis. Clearly, at that time, there was, at least with many of economists and policymakers, a misconception about what the monetary union really is. I remember people saying that that the balance of payments don't matter anymore. Current accounts are not important. Nobody was looking really at the unit labor cost developments, except for few people who were warning, look, there is a dispersion, it cannot go on forever. But that was kind of too lightly dismissed as an argument. It looked like, you know, this is a heaven place where everybody's protected by the common currency and the benefits that we were mentioning, some of the benefits that we were mentioning. But it's not like that, obviously. And this crisis, debt crisis, was a rude awakening for everyone. And that has created, of course, the policy reaction. And the policy reaction was such that at the moment, obviously, countries in the Eurozone do not have nearly the extent of external imbalances that they had at that time. Nearly such a divergence in the unit labor cost developments as was the case at that time. EDP was established, macroeconomic imbalances procedure were established. So no matter of, we can discuss how are they implemented, whether they are well implemented, etc. That would take another podcast probably. But they are there, and things are monitored, and people are aware of these risks. Then you had the ESM, which has been established with 500 billion euros firepower, which is important thing and has helped a number of countries through the programs already. Then the OMT was set up then. Outright monetary transactions, which then in the end tops up the firepower of the ESM itself, because can include the ECB intervention in the government bond market conditional on a program with the ESM. Yeah. Recently, you have the transmission protection instrument of the ECB, also never used, but as a standing facility there, which, as we saw, calmed markets the moment it was established. And you have, of course, the importantly, and now we're getting to the banking union, enhanced supervision, micro and macroprudential policies, because in some countries it was the banking system, like Ireland, which actually caused a huge problem, fiscal problem for the country. In other countries, it was a government finances that created the problems for the banks. And then you have also even signs that in times of a crisis, you could have some of the common fiscal response, and that was proven by the agreement on the NGEU in 2010.
The next generation EU funds.
Yes, next generation EU funds. So if you take all that together, yeah, we are in a better situation than we were then. Then there were many mistakes. People didn't understand the real risks, even within the monetary union. But that doesn't mean that there is no risk in the future. We still have a problem of large public debts, which have actually increased since then rather than decreased, and the dispersion of these public debt levels. And this is something on which should be addressed. And in my view, the convergence of public debt levels is something which would make the monetary union more efficient and more stable in the future. So we have to work on that. And that, as we know, works. That can be done from two sides. One is the prudent fiscal policy, but the other one is structural policies, which increase the growth. I mean, if you look at the Croatian story of reducing the public debt to GDP rapidly, it was a combination of the two. It's impossible to do it without the growth, also potential growth being improved. So overall, I would say, yeah, we're in a better position. We learned lessons, but the risks are still there, and they have to be addressed in the future. We cannot say, okay, now we're fine. We did what we had to do, and the risk of the debt crisis in the Eurozone is negligible. Right. It is not.
But you do, or you did just make it sound like that remaining work is largely a national responsibility in bringing down debt levels from the currently elevated levels. But as far as institutional reform is concerned, though, like you said, we have had, you know, real progress in mainly in two areas. We have now mechanisms that prevent a panic in government debt markets, right? A rollover crisis, and that help countries adjust, that provide financing to countries in an idiosyncratic way if they need it through a mechanism like the European Stability Mechanism, the ESM, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, we have, you know, the, you know, arguably something that should nip private debt crisis in the bud, which is the common banking supervision. Now, nonetheless, you know, debt crisis and banking crisis can happen even in well-supervised systems. And you know, Croatia particularly was the victim of a significant banking system instability even before it joined the EU, right? And the global financial crisis when it was linked through cross-border banking relationships to banks that got into trouble. So do you think in this area there has been enough, so particularly in the area of bank resolution, and do you see this as a top priority to push this further, or are you relatively relaxed about this?
No, I think that there's still a need for further improvements in the banking sector in Europe. Overall, I still think that the banking sector is overbanked, that we need to, in some areas, in some countries, still reduce the NPLs, that the risks that are consequence of the high exposure of many banks to their own governments are still there. This nexus has not been broken fully. We did things to improve the risk management there, but it's still there. We still don't have a common deposit insurance, which does not make the banking union complete, standing on three legs, but only on two legs. And I would say that the reforms in the banking system are still pending. I can tell you that, for example, from Croatian experience, when I joined the central bank as a policymaker, it was in 1998 already as a head of the research. Then I became policymaker in 2000. But then we had 60 credit institutions in Croatia. Now we have 20. So we reduced the number of banks by 2/3. And I think this is the way to go. Overbanked market does not make it efficient market and creates the vulnerabilities which sooner or later will emerge. Sometimes you can put the things under the carpet, but this is not the way how you solve them. So the capitalization of the banks has to be adequate. I was always pushing for a higher capital that the banks should have, CET1. We achieved now a good capitalization of the banks by combination, actually, of the capital adequacy plus the MREL. The other bail-inable assets that they need to have. It is a kind of a quite heavy requirement sometimes for the banks, particularly MREL. Maybe it could have done. This is what I proposed at that time, simply through the tier one capital, rather than having the MREL and this. But the way the banks argued that regulators wanted it led to this kind of a solution, whether it's optimal or not, the time will show. Nor we have time also to discuss all the things about that. I would say again, in a conclusion to your question about the banking supervision and banking union, no, we're not complete with that reform either. Right.
Excellent. So I'm afraid we will need to slowly close since we are at the end of our allocated time. So I would really like to thank you, Governor Vučić, and thank our listeners and wish you all the best. I think the Eurozone has been enriched by Croatia's accession, and certainly the Governing Council has been enriched by, or will be enriched by, your presence in the near future when you go there in your new capacity shortly. As always, our listeners can find related work on our website, www.bruegel.org, particularly on the issue of banking union. We have a recent paper written by a collection of authors, including Jean Pinoni Ferry, Nicolas Véran, and myself. And there's also a very good piece that will come out shortly by Nicolas that goes into the same direction, actually, as some of the things that you just mentioned, in particular the idea that maybe Tier 1 capital should go up and maybe the requirements on bail-inable capital should be less mechanical, precisely the argument you you just made. But for now, thank you so much, Governor Vučić, and bye-bye. I hope we'll meet.
Thank you, Jeremy. It was a great pleasure to talk to you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Bye-bye. Thanks.